Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
The team at the Investigators and Burning Mountain Productions would like to remind you that persons associated with crimes or potential wrongdoing discussed on this episode are presumed innocent until proven otherwise in a court of law or administrative action.
Oh, I've been running from the law. Hope they won't shoot me down soon.
I'm Todd McComas.
And I'm Jessica Knoll, and we are
the Investigators.
Try to catch me howling at the moon.
Welcome back to all our partners in crime. We hope you had a crime-free week. And if you did not, we hope that everyone is okay and that you have the right investigators on the case.
And if you don't, reach out to us. That's what we're here for, to dig for answers and the truth. And to give a voice to the voiceless and to shine a light on your story.
I had fun this weekend. It was my wife's birthday. So she planned this trip. She's done it every year for like the last 4 years or so. We went tubing on the river.
Did you just say that she planned this for her birthday?
Yeah, it's a
ritual.
Come
on.
You know, she's so anal about it and she needs things to be just the right way that she handles all the organization.
That sounds like me and my husband.
A lot of people think when you say tubing, like you're being pulled by a boat, you're skipping along the water and it's an adrenaline filled ride. This is lazy person tubing. You just float down the river. You get your big group. They got these little tethers where you can strap each inner tube to one another. So you're in a big circle. And then you have coolers floating on their own floats that are tethered in the middle of your circle, so everybody has access to beer, snacks, seltzers, whatever it is that you bring.
So you just went down a river taking a nap?
Basically, yes. Two people in our group, I'm not going to call them out by name, Angie's dad and our friend Rachel, passed out during the trip. Drank a lot. It's sunny. It's really comfortable. It was just the right temperature. And listen, it was cloudy. And for some reason in my brain, I'm like half Native American as far as my complexion goes. But obviously you can see me. I'm very Irish. So I don't tan well, despite what my brain tells me. I require like, I don't know, SPF 4000.
You're quite red today.
Today's the first day I could sit in a chair. We were supposed to record this 2 days ago, but I've had to stand for 4 days because I'm so sunburned. Like I've been sleeping standing up like I'm a horse. That's how bad my sunburn is. Have you ever been so sunburnt like the inside of your eyelids hurt? Like it hurts to blink. You're so sunburnt. That's how sunburnt I got. And, you know, all of us were this way growing up. Our moms warned us. It's the cloudy days that get you. And I know this because it's not my first day on the planet. And still, when my wife said, hey, would you like to put on some of this sunblock? I'm like, no.
I'm not going to call you out on your age, but we're adults. You should know better. You're going to be a cherry by the end of this. Like, why?
It's just something in my brain. It's like, dude, you're like a super tan person. It's like, no, we can see you. You're Larry Bird. Like, I'm that pale. And I just refuse to do the things necessary to keep myself from frying to a crisp.
And a full disclosure, you know, I train for marathons in the summer, and I'm currently doing that now. So I'm usually pretty diligent, but not when I run because I don't like that feeling on my skin. Because let me tell you, going out and running in this humidity, I get sticky enough without having something else on me. But I do get, unlike you, I do get tan over the course of my training, but my tan lines are pretty ridiculous. Not just shorts and not just tank top, but you see this headband I'm wearing today. Like when I start to run, I'll get a line all the way across my forehead because I wear a running headband. And it looks like, if you look at vacation pictures of me last year, it looks like I didn't put makeup on part of my forehead. And it's just a wicked tan line.
I can't tan. Well, I only have two colors, white and red. That's it. It's starting to drive me crazy, especially like I'm letting my beard get really gray again. So the contrast between the red and the gray, it's not a good look for camera.
You could be Santa this coming December.
I have been Santa before. We'll save that for another story. I was Santa at a comedy club once and the kids hated it, but the parents loved it.
The kids hated it.
Okay, enough about the lack of pigment in my skin. Everyone grab a shovel, because we're getting ready to dig into this week's case. Now, in most cases we'll cover, we'll have police reports, autopsy records, and other records to work from, but this is a missing persons case, specifically a case involving a missing child. So we're relying heavily on an amazing foster mom and advocacy group that have compiled a plethora of information about the case and the timeline,
as well as local news stories that have kept up with the investigation over the last couple of years. But for us, sometimes bringing awareness to a case is the most we can do, and we're always honored to do so.
Okay, we're heading to the Pacific Northwest for this one, starting in the small town of Oakville, Washington, about an hour and a half southwest of Seattle.
At the center of this case is a 5-year-old girl. She stands a mere 3 feet tall, has warm brown eyes and dark brown hair, and has a smile so big it wrinkles her tiny nose. But the thing that's maybe the most unforgettable about her is her infectious, bubbly giggle. That little girl with the sweet giggle vanished just 4 days before Valentine's Day in 2021, although the last verified sighting of her was 10 months prior to that.
And police have their sights set on two suspects.
This is Oakley Lynn Carlson's story.
That was from a video taken by Oakley's foster mom, Jamie Jo Hiles, when Oakley was only 2 years old.
A simple giggle once heard echoing throughout Jamie Jo's home, expressed many times during Oakley's favorite activities, dancing, singing, and retelling her foster dad's jokes, following up quickly without missing a beat with a
waka waka. That's Fozzie from the Muppets, by the way. That was a pretty good impression.
These days, however, it's a sound that evokes a haunting, heartbreaking reminder that she's gone, leaving them with the mystery of Oakley's whereabouts, like an imminent dark overcast that the sun cannot pierce.
Where is Oakley right now, and what happened to her? Those are the questions that Jamie Jo prays are answered, and soon. And despite the odds, she clings to the hope that one day she'll hear that giggle in person again.
Sitting down to talk with us, we notice she's wearing a beautiful pearl and diamond gold necklace. So we ask her about it.
On my very first Mother's Day, Eric took Oakley to a jewelry store and picked out this little necklace. So today when I was getting ready, I was like, oh, I'm going to wear my Mother's Day necklace. Like, I never got to celebrate Mother's Day before. So I was like, I'm going to wear my Mother's Day necklace.
Oakley made her a mom because, as she explained to her,
we did explain to her, you know, you didn't grow in my stomach, but you grew in my heart.
And it's in Jamie Jo's heart where Oakley remains today. And every day, the little girl who took her first steps in front of her and was the first child to call her mama and say, I love you, will always have a piece of Jamie Jo's heart earmarked just for her.
Oakley, can you show me your art?
Look, mama.
I love it.
Thank you, mama.
Their story together began when Oakley was just 8 months old in August 2017. The high school teacher and her husband decided to open their home to the infant. And for the next 2 years, they soaked up every moment together as a family.
She loved to garden in it. Like, sometimes she would ask me if she could just go lay in the dirt I just have pictures of her just like face down in the dirt with her little arms up, and she has these little boots on, and she liked to be one with the earth, I guess. And we'd get her little, like, we got her little apron with unicorns on it and like little, like, you know, a bucket and tools so that she could be out in the garden next to my dad. And she would help him pick strawberries and put bird feed in the birdhouse. And so I miss that because, you know, that's just something that, like, for 2 years I enjoyed watching her learning how to walk out in the garden, but then also be like, she was really helpful in the garden. Like, it's hard to bend over and pick those strawberries, but Oakley could do it. We love Disney movies around here. And so one time we were watching WALL-E, and she started crying when she realized that WALL-E was alone on this planet. And I asked her why she was crying, and she was like, he doesn't have any friends.
Even as a tiny child, Oakley was filled with love and empathy. And for the Hiles, what began as a foster home situation soon turned into the young couple wanting to adopt Oakley.
And that was the plan until November of 2019, just before Oakley's third birthday. That's when the Department of Children, Youth, and Families took her from the Hiles home and returned her to her biological parents.
After an emotional Thanksgiving dinner with the entire Hiles extended family, where everyone hugged Oakley and said their tearful goodbyes, she was taken from their home. For Jamie Jo and her husband Eric, it was heartbreaking to lose the little girl they'd raised for 2 years as their very own and who they'd grown more in love with by the day. But they never thought they'd lose her forever.
Okay, you've been read into Oakley's case, and you've heard from her foster mom, Jamie Jo, and even Oakley herself. Now it's time to join us in the war room so we can take a deeper dive into what we know about Oakley's case.
Okay, Todd, let's start with something we do have from the Grays Harbor County Sheriff's Office, Oakley's missing persons flyer. Because it has a few things I think are very telling about this investigation. First, the top of the flyer sheds light on the sheriff's office investigation with the words missing/presumed dead in all caps. So from that, we already know that they're searching for her, but in all likeliness, it's a recovery mission.
Unfortunately, yeah. I mean, even though I'm sure they're trying to hang on to hope as well, they are cops. And as such, they know it's far more likely this is a recovery mission, simply because of how long it's been since anyone has seen Oakley. And because, as you'll hear soon enough, there's been some shit go down.
There are three lines in that flyer that immediately stick out to me. First, the Grays Harbor County Sheriff's Office is seeking information regarding the disappearance and suspected homicide of Oakley Carlson.
That's very specific language, and it excludes other explanations like accident or illness, for example.
And Oakley's parents, Andrew Carlson and Jordan Bowers, were contacted and provided conflicting statements about her whereabouts. These statements were later proven to be false.
Love it. Right away, they're saying to readers of the flyer, maybe you know Oakley's parents, and if that's the case, just know we did talk to them, and they lied their asses off. So don't buy whatever it is they're selling. That's what that flyer says.
And there's more about them, Todd. Both Andrew Carlson and Jordan Bowers remain suspects in the disappearance of Oakley Carlson, who were later arrested and convicted of child abuse unrelated to the disappearance of Oakley.
This might be the greatest missing child's flyer of all time. And in case you still have the urge to buy what they're selling, just know they were convicted of abusing one of their other children. If there was a Pulitzer Prize or even an Emmy for missing persons flyer copy, this would get a nom for sure. By the way, Jessica has 3 Emmys.
Oh, okay. Thanks for the poorly timed plug, but it is a great flyer, and that's why we started with it. So to understand what might have happened to Oakley, we need to take a hard look at her last moments seen by anyone, and then branch out to what's happened since then. That takes us to the holiday season, 1 year after she leaves the Hiles home and is placed back into the custody of her biological parents. Here are a few times leading up to her disappearance when Oakley was reportedly seen. Oakley spends Christmas Day 2020 with her biological family at her grandparents' home. Her grandmother allegedly tells police that Oakley looked very pale. She had dark circles under her eyes and sores and scratches on her face. A month later, Jamie Jo says she sees photos of Oakley's disturbing appearance and calls the Washington State Department of Children, Youth, and Families, better known as DCYF. And a few weeks later, February 10th, 2021, is the last time anyone reports seeing Oakley.
So perhaps we're learning that people who cared about Oakley were seeing evidence that her care at home hasn't improved. At least that's what people who genuinely care about Oakley are concerned about, which is a description that would, in my opinion, exclude the people at DCYF that literally held Oakley's well-being in their cold and calloused hands.
You're so wishy-washy with your opinions.
I'll try to get better at it. And hopefully the people at DCYF will try to get better at their jobs.
But it sounds like her grandmother and Jamie Jo were trying. And even though they reported their concerns, Oakley hasn't been reported missing yet, and she won't be for months. Special Services Chief Paul Logan with the Grays Harbor County Sheriff's Office has been investigating Oakley's case since day one. He tells us how the reaction from her biological parents immediately raised red flags for him.
I think the non-concern on their part, I've seen that quite a bit where a parent will report that their child's missing. And when we respond, they're tearing apart the house and the child might be in a playhouse or might be in the garage or has just wandered to the neighbor or something like that. But there's still that reaction that a parent has. And when you don't see that, that's very concerning. We noted that very early in the investigation. Since that time, we've developed additional evidence that I'm not going to discuss. But at the same time, we've not developed any evidence that would tell us that we're not looking in the right direction.
So let's look at those around her in her life. More importantly, what was going on in their lives leading up to her disappearance?
Let's start with her biological parents, Jordan Bowers and Andrew Carlson. Here's a few things we know about them. Andrew was a police officer for a bit in the neighboring town of Aberdeen. In 2017, he was fired for allegedly making false statements. We couldn't find the details of those allegations, but when you're caught lying, especially if it's in a report or in testimony, it's tough for your department to keep you around anymore as a cop. Because from that point on, every time you're called to testify in court, the defense attorney will no doubt introduce to the jury that incident where you lied to impeach your testimony in this case. So as far as the court goes, once a liar, always a liar. You can't be a cop anymore.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
So Jordan and Andrew share four children, including Oakley. And according to police, Jordan has a gambling problem. And both she and Andrew are addicted to meth, which also makes it hard for a department to keep you around as a cop. And even though Jordan was never a cop, she's no stranger to handcuffs. And since they've been together, Andrew has also gotten used to wearing them instead of carrying them.
In July 2018, while 1.5-year-old Oakley is living with the Hiles, Andrew, the man who once wore a uniform like you, Todd, and promised to serve and protect, is arrested for assault.
Specifically, domestic assault. On July 30th, 2018, he was arrested for assaulting Jordan. And as, I'm assuming, part of a plea agreement or deferment of prosecution of some sort, he is ordered by the court to undergo a domestic violence evaluation within 90 days of his release. And from there, he has to successfully complete the recommended treatment program, or I assume, go to jail. That's usually how that works.
And we feel it's important to mention Andrew's history of violence, at least against Jordan, because on March 7th, 2019, Oakley comes home from a supervised visit with Andrew and Jordan when Jamie, Joe, and Eric notice she has red marks and scratches on her cheeks. And when Jamie Joe asks the visit supervisor what happened, she said she had no idea.
I'm guessing she was supervising from afar, like maybe the front seat of her car while taking a nap far?
Perhaps. But Jamie Joe did do her due diligence and reported the red marks and scratches and the fact that no one bothered to change her diaper to Oakley's caseworker, and she never heard back.
Then in May of 2019, the domestic violence treatment program that Andrew was court ordered to complete notifies DCYF that they've kicked Andrew out of the program because he just stopped showing up. Screw your court order, judge, and screw you, DCYF. You don't know me and you don't own me. I don't need training on domestic violence. I'm already good at it. That wasn't a quote. That was me doing a made up impression.
I'm glad you clarified that, Todd. And maybe Jordan was no slouch herself, because in October of that same year, Jamie Joe says Oakley told her she saw Jordan hit Andrew during her last visitation with them. And once again, Jamie Joe reported it. And this time, she did get a response from her caseworker. She said there were no concerns and that Oakley loves her mom and dad.
And I think Jordan and Andrew love their visitation supervisor and caseworker. They're pretty easy.
Well, speaking of them, it's decided shortly thereafter that there's no longer a need for supervised visitation. So from now on, the visits will be unsupervised.
As if they weren't already.
Again, with the beating around the bush, Todd. But also, Jordan and Andrew were authorized overnight visits with Oakley. And when Jamie Joe expressed her concerns that this was all happening way too quickly, her caseworker gave them an, oh, by the way, Oakley will be reunifying with her biological parents even earlier than expected with a new date of November 29th, 2019. And as promised, Oakley is taken back by DCYF to live with Andrew and Jordan on that date.
I'm going to jump ahead a bit because in July 2020, there's a custody hearing for one of their other children that noted some concerns. First, it was noted in the record that Jordan told her social worker that she knew how to beat a urinalysis test. Secondly, it was noted in the record that Jordan lied about completing court-ordered domestic violence treatment programs herself, and that DCYF has no record of whether or not she even attended those. And finally, it's noted in the record that Jordan and Andrew failed to attend an important hospital appointment for their disabled child. According to one sheriff's office report, Oakley's sister is blind in both eyes and suffers from a condition known as failed to thrive, a condition that affects her pituitary gland, which stunts her growth and causes many associated health issues. To treat her condition, she is prescribed injections of growth hormone, which she must receive daily or her condition will worsen. Now, on the date of this report, Jordan was in jail. So Detective Heller asked an officer at the jail to ask Jordan about her daughter's medication. And according to the jail officer, Jordan told him she's not on meds. However, physicians at Marybridge Children's Hospital confirmed that was not true, and that indeed her daughter requires an injection of this medication every single day. Now, it's important to note that Oakley's sister began this treatment in March of 2019 while in foster care. And on December 16, 2019, she and her sister Oakley were removed from foster care per a judge's order and returned to the care of Jordan and Andrew. After which, Jordan and Andrew were court-ordered to continue their disabled daughter's medical treatment and administer her medication as prescribed. They were both provided training to properly do so. But according to Medicaid records, no prescriptions for the required medication were filled since August of 2020. This report was taken on December 16, 2021. So as Detective Heller notes in his report, this disabled child had not received this vital daily medication in 15 months. 15 months, even though both Jordan and Andrew were provided free training and a gas card so they wouldn't be financially burdened for having to care for this particular child. It kind of makes me wonder, What the hell happened to that gas card? And listen, I'm not going to make any accusations. I'm just going to give them the benefit of the doubt because I'm sure it was just some kind of accident. They probably lost it, and then some meth dealer happened to find it on the ground, picked it up, and used it to buy shit that meth dealers need. And that, of course, is in no way the fault of Jordan and Andrew.
Maybe, because it seems like they're beginning a string of bad luck. 10 months after the last known sighting of Oakley, a call comes in to 911. It's Andrew Carlson, and it's November 6th, 2021. But he's not reporting his daughter missing. He's calling about a fire which he tells the dispatcher Oakley ignited with a lighter inside their rural home. A few days later, the elementary school principal checks in on the displaced family who's now staying at the Extended Stay America in neighboring Tumwater, Washington. During that visit, she never actually lays eyes on little Oakley. And when she asks about her, her parents tell her that Oakley's just in her room.
Okay, if you're that elementary school principal, kids do play in their room. I mean, that's a thing.
Yeah, but she returns to the home a few weeks later and again doesn't see Oakley.
Okay, now maybe the hair on the back of your neck starts to stand up just a little bit.
Well, it gets worse. Because according to Jamie Joe, on December 4th, Oakley's 6-year-old sister spends the night at the principal's home, and she allegedly tells that principal, Oakley is no more.
Call the police.
Oh, don't you worry. The next day, the principal calls the sheriff's office, asking them to check on Oakley. And the following morning, the Tumwater Police Department goes to the Extended Stay America to interview Oakley's parents.
Here's what has me all kinds of pissed off. This family is still under the supervision of DCYF, and no one has seen Oakley since mid-February. This is December we're talking about, and their house has burnt to the ground. What the hell is happening? How about after the fire, someone at DCYF demand they line up all their damn kids and have a head count?
I think that's a brilliant idea, but it didn't happen. What did happen, after police show up for that welfare check on Oakley and speak to her parents, is Andrew calls the Thurston County non-emergency line to then report his daughter missing, telling them he hasn't seen her since November 30th. That's 24 days after the house fire, and approximately a week before their other daughter tells the principal that Oakley is no more. And now, finally, 1 month after the house fire, a missing persons report is finally filed on Oakley's 5th birthday, leading to an extensive search for Oakley spanning over several days. The Washington State Police, the FBI, and Grays Harbor County Sheriff's Office peel their way through the layers of the lush, thick forest terrain. They sift through hundreds of acres on and around the family's home, on the ground, in the air, and in water.
Jesus, stepson of Joseph, on her birthday. Here's what I think happened. They knew Grandma and others that loved Oakley would demand to see her on her birthday, right? That's going to happen. And they knew they could not produce Oakley on her birthday. And they knew what that would most likely lead to, more attention. So they decided to get ahead of that and finally report her missing. It's so freaking disgusting. Plus, Andrew and Jordan were facing criminal charges regarding their 6-year-old child for child endangerment. So that would obviously mean even more DCYF visits and increased DCYF supervision.
Would it?
Well, that's a great question. Here's another question. Why do people like this seem to be extra fertile? Here we have JB Joe and her husband who struggle to have a child of their own. And then we have these two less than outstanding members of society who could get pregnant from a dirty text message.
Here's an example of what Todd's so vaguely referring to. In this new child endangerment case, DCYF takes hair follicle samples from Oakley's 6-year-old sister and 2-year-old brother and submit them for analysis. And I know you'll find this hard to believe, but the tests reveal substantial amounts of methamphetamine in both hair follicle samples, obviously indicating the children were both exposed to meth within the last 3 months.
But their disabled daughter can't get the prescribed non-meth medication she actually needs. That's awesome.
Well, they both plead not guilty of second-degree abandonment of a dependent child for failing to provide their child with her medication. And the prosecutor's office says, okay, then, you want to play that way? Here's two more criminal counts to plead not guilty to. Okay, that was not a direct quote. Todd made me try my hand at impressions.
It wasn't bad.
Yeah, thanks. And they add two counts of endangerment with a controlled substance to each of their cases, citing results from the hair follicle test that show methamphetamine in both hair samples. And their trial dates are set for April 2022, but they plead guilty in February.
I like what the judge told Andrew at his sentencing. The Honorable Judge Svoboda stated, "It's a father's job to protect their children. You certainly failed in that, Mr. Carlson."
And that was a direct quote.
Yes, because my judge impression, way better than that. I would add that it's a certain government agency's job to protect the children they are assigned to manage as well. He was sentenced to the maximum 12 months in jail, but was released after serving less than 8 months. Jordan was sentenced to 20 months in prison for two counts of child endangerment with a controlled substance. And surprise, surprise, after his early release, Andrew puts his usual amount of energy into correcting his behavior and becoming a proper father and viable member of society, and fails to complete any of his court-ordered treatment programs.
And after her release, Jordan gets arrested for identity theft.
Wouldn't it be ironic if she stole the identity of an even worse mom?
Todd, I'm not sure that's possible, but she pleads not guilty to all counts against her in January 2023 and faces 63 to 85 months in prison if she's convicted.
In the meantime, they've both been playing cat and mouse games with the legal system that seems to be doing its very best to keep them out of prison. But I don't want to lump police in with this network of chaos I'm referring to as this area's legal system.
Yeah, because it seems as though at least they're trying, because they've officially labeled Oakley's biological parents, Andrew Carlson and Jordan Bowers, as suspects, according to the sheriff's office. But as of the release of this episode, neither have been charged with any crime in connection to Oakley's disappearance or possible death. However, the sheriff's office has stated to local media that the pair has been less than cooperative with their investigation.
And we know the sheriff's office believes Andrew and Jordan are withholding information that will not only provide answers to what happened to Oakley, but also where they can find her. And even though we don't know all the evidence they have, we are sure there's one statement in particular that fuels their pursuit of Oakley's parents as suspects. A statement that came from Oakley's 6-year-old disabled sister. In her forensic interview with Nina Taylor of the Children's Advocacy Center, she said that Oakley did start the fire the night of November 6th with their mother's torch, and that their mother yelled at her and gave her a very bad spanking for it. She also told the interviewer that her mother, Jordan, had told her that Oakley had gone into the woods and had been eaten by wolves, and that she was never to speak of Oakley to anyone ever again. That's a haunting statement. And there's one particular group that comes to mind that it should especially haunt.
As for those charged with looking out for the well-being of children and protecting children in this area, like Oakley, they've been under heavy fire since her disappearance.
As they should be, despite zero evidence that Oakley's biological parents had complied with court-ordered mandates or cleaned themselves up or had improved the neglectful and abusive environment that served as the very reason for Oakley being removed from their home in the first place, DCYF removed Oakley from a loving, nurturing home even earlier than expected. And the reason Jamie Jo and her husband say they were given as to why, well, her parents have another baby on the way. So when that happens, we like to reunify the family. Not that they've stopped using meth or stopped beating the shit out of each other, or even that they have complied with one single thing they were required to. Just, well, they're pregnant again. That agency needs a federal audit. And every caseworker who has been assigned to Oakley's well-being should have every step of that assignment thoroughly examined to determine whether or not they should remain licensed in that state or any state for that matter.
Well, interestingly enough, in May of 2022, Washington Governor Jay Inslee spurs a review of DCYF, specifically in how they handled Oakley's case. In response to the overwhelming public scrutiny they faced concerning Oakley's disappearance, and at the urging of the governor, the Washington State Office of the Family and Children's Ombuds released their investigative report in September of 2022, stating, DCYF's actions and conduct in this case were consistent with laws, policies, and court orders.
For Pete's sake, of course they did. Every member of that review panel should be forced to let Oakley's biological parents babysit their kids.
Well, maybe they'll become foster parents.
That would be so fitting for the state.
January of 2023, the proposed Oakley-Carlson Act was presented to the Washington State House of Representatives. House Bill 1397 focuses on maintaining the safety of children who have been removed from a parent based on abuse, neglect, or abandonment. And it cites Oakley's disappearance in particular. Little girl vanished after being removed from loving foster parents and returned to troubled birth parents raises serious questions about the effectiveness of our state's child welfare policies and bureaucracies.
Yes. Can I get an amen?
Amen. The goal for this bill is to improve the overall oversight and operations of DCYF, specifically pertaining to outlining clear standards for returning children to their birth parents who've lost custody in hopes of reducing the risk of harm to them. And finally, the purpose of the Oakley-Carlson Act is to, quote, create positive change from the sadness and sorrow of young Oakley's disappearance. It's been more than 2 years since Oakley vanished. Her case remains open with the Grays Harbor Sheriff's Office.
Oakley is a pure victim. You know, she's just a beautiful, sweet little girl. So none of this is her fault. Being a parent myself, I want to do what I can for somebody who can't protect themselves. So this one kind of hit me a little bit personal. So my sheriff has allowed me to remain lead with this case. That being said, the detectives that are working 24 or working full detective shifts now, I have more of an administrative role also. They still work this case every week. We all do. We all follow bleeds. We all continue to work it. And I would say it's just as personal for them. Some cases just hit you from the minute you start on them. And this is definitely one of those. And, you know, they're the same way. It doesn't matter whether the other case comes in. We always go back to this one as soon as we can. And we'll continue to do that.
And Chief Logan is getting all of his ducks in a row because he's only got one shot at those responsible.
The way our courts are set up, the way the laws are set up, the way the Constitution is set up, you're innocent until proven guilty. We get one shot at charges once they're filed. And once we go into a trial phase, the last thing we want is to have one juror with a doubt in their mind at the end of the case and have the person go free. So in our world, it's better to wait until we can find everything that there is to find and we can put together the best case we possibly can. Our prosecutors here have been involved with this case since day one. We've not forwarded a case back into them yet, but as far as advice, guidance, we've sought guidance from other prosecutors' offices and other experts that have done more of this type of case, be it other law enforcement, local, federal, and they've all said the same thing. Until you know you've got it all, until you're ready to go, just keep building the case because you're only going to get one shot at this.
So we went through everything we had access to, and we had access to that thanks in large part to Light the Way, a missing persons advocacy group, Oakley's foster mom, Jamie Jo Hiles, and the Grays Harbor County Sheriff's Office.
Oakley would be 6 years old today. At the time she disappeared, she was 3 feet tall with brown hair and brown eyes. And there's an age progression photo of her both on the Justice for Oakley website and on the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children website, showing what she might look like today.
It's kind of like Groundhog's Day almost, you know, where I wake up every morning and the first thing I do is check my phone. I have Detective Logan on my like special list. So if he called me during the middle of the night, like when my phone is on do not disturb, like Detective Logan can get through. I check every day to see right away if I've gotten any text messages. But, you know, it's just that every day of like, maybe today will be the day. And I asked my husband last week, we were driving up to Olympia, and it's a 30-minute drive, so we always have so much to talk about. But I was like, what would we do if we got the phone call that they found Oakley alive and she was coming back to us? And Eric's like, we throw the sheets in the wash, but we got to get her room ready. And I was like, yep.
Here's what you can do to help in Oakley's case. Share her story and her photos all over social media. And most importantly, keep talking about her.
I know this sounds cliche to say, but if you know something, say something. Call or email a tip to the Grays Harbor County Sheriff's Office. There's an $85,000 reward being offered for information leading to the location and recovery of Oakley. And I want to give a big shout out once again to Light the Way. It's a missing persons advocacy project that has links and materials detailing all of the ways that you can help Oakley, including sample letters to the governor and the Washington State Department of Children, Youth, and Families. You can find information for all of those in the show notes for this episode, as well as photos of Oakley on our website, investigatorspodcast.com. We'll be sure to post updates on Oakley's case as soon as we get them.
And beyond that, Jamie Joe wants us to remind everyone, never stop talking and never stop looking for Oakley Lynn Carlson. For Jamie Joe, Oakley changed her life forever. She's taught her patience, understanding, and grace. She learned a lot about herself through Oakley's own sweet nature and compassion for others. To the little girl who loves to dance, play in the dirt, and who never met a stranger, her mama wants her to know,
I will, for the rest of my life, I will fight for her. Even if it's in her honor, I will always fight for her and make sure that people don't forget her name.
If you have a case you'd like us to dig into, email the details to theinvestigatorpodcast@gmail.com.
And follow us on social media at The Investigators Podcast.
If you like this show, please tell your friends and take a moment to rate and write a review. We appreciate your feedback and your generous stars.
Oh, and by the way, Jessica and I will be at CrimeCon in Orlando this September. So if you're going to be there too, make sure you stop by and say hello.
Yes, because we want to meet all of our partners in crime in person. We'll be on Podcast Row at the Burning Mountain Productions booth. Until next week, please take a moment and hug the ones you love.
And remember, there's a special place in hell for people who hurt kids. So if you see it happening, or you even suspect it's happening, report it. Most agencies will do their job from there. And if they don't, they can deal with us. Because we're the investigators!
I came from the mud, there's dirt on my head. Strong like a tree, there's roots where I stand. Oh, I've been running from the law. Hope they won't shoot me down soon. They seem gonna sleep this night. Try to catch me howling at the moon.
Are you someone who watches every true crime documentary the day that it releases and then find yourself always wanting to know more, Googling the timelines, red flags, and then falling into the social media rabbit hole? Well, I'm here to do all of that for you, bringing the facts, theories, and details that no one else is covering on my hit true crime podcast, Serialistly with Annie Elise. Whether it's everything with the Idaho 4 case, now that the documents are unsealed, or shocking cases you've never heard of, packed with love triangles, cults, and twists you won't see coming. With over 1 million downloads a week, I break it down for you just like your best friend would. Serialistly with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.